From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On any given day in post-war Iraq, an undeclared war continues to rage. Nearly 2 months after President Bush declared an end to major combat, American and British soldiers are confronted with Iraqi resistance, bitterness, and increasingly deadly attacks on the steamy streets and sandy outposts of a country that seems to be in limbo. Last week, senior defense officials signaled that U.S. forces might remain in Iraq for as long as a decade. In Congress, an estimated cost of $3 billion a month for rebuilding has been tossed around. What is the United States really up against in the occupation of Iraq? We'll be talking tonight with an A-list of foreign correspondents fresh back with a first-hand view. We're inviting them to shake off the dust, put their feet up, and take us on an unvarnished street-level tour of post-war Iraq. There's no deadline to meet and no editor breathing down anyone's neck. Just a hunger to know tonight on Point, witnesses to the occupation. You can join the conversation. What is your sense of what the U.S. is in for in Iraq? Are Americans getting the full picture? And what's your question for the correspondents fresh back from Baghdad, Basra, and Points North? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from a well-deserved vacation retreat on Chesapeake Bay, Virginia, is Adam Piori, general editor for Newsweek magazine. He was embedded with the 3rd Armored Cavalry near the Syrian border during the war and left occupied Iraq last week. Good evening and welcome, Adam Piori.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. Also with us, so we'll be joined later in the hour with folks from Rome, from Los Angeles, but right now from Istanbul, Turkey, Eileen Prusher. She is Istanbul bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor, covered the war as a unilateral from northern Iraq in the Kurdish self-ruled area, spent the last month in Baghdad and left just 6 days ago. Good evening, and it's good to have you back, Eileen Prusher.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Eileen, Adam, here in the United States, we are watching these reports daily, shaking our heads, trying to get a grip, keep a grip on what's going on in Iraq. The big death toll of British soldiers yesterday and the large number of attacks around the country have us wondering yet again. We're hoping that tonight you will, as I said, kind of put your feet up and tell us the stories that you brought out of your very recent weeks there that, in your mind, best help us understand what's going on. Adam, I wonder if I can turn to you first. Here we are looking at what one can't help fearing is a kind of guerrilla war after the big war. When you sit down with your family, with your friends just back from Iraq and tell them the insights, the anecdotes that unlock some understanding of this, what do you tell them about?
Well, I guess, I mean, the thing for me is that when you read about the attacks in the newspapers here, it seems like it's one monolithic place, but Iraq is very large. So a lot of these attacks around the country, if something happens down south, the common soldier probably won't even hear about it for a couple of days up north, if they hear about it at all. And what they're confronted with, at least when I was there and where I was sporadic attacks. People shooting at them or even firing RPGs, but they rarely hit anything. So, after a while, it seemed like the soldiers even got used to it, and it was rare that anyone was actually killed. Of course, eventually they did, an ambush did kill a major in the unit I was with, and that sent shockwaves through the unit, but it's just not the constant sense of danger that you read about in the paper.
So when you're there at one point on the map in a country the size of, I don't know, California, you don't always feel the knife at your throat. On the other hand, we have now seen, since the fall of Baghdad on April 9th, some 92 Americans have died. There were only 102 killed in the intensive fighting in the 3 weeks before that. The British numbers are up now. There must be the sense among American soldiers in Iraq that they're at risk. 24 attacks yesterday, the Wall Street Journal reports. That's a lot in one day.
Yeah, I mean, it really is complicating efforts to try and keep the peace there and try and move towards a post-war stability. I mean, up in Al-Qaim, where I am, there's constant complaints about them moving through neighborhoods in armored vehicles and bringing helicopters into the town. And, of course, every time there's an attack, that's what they do. And that just creates more tension with the local populace. They're trying to set up a new government, a new local government there, get services up and going. So it is causing more security and more unease and complicating the situation.
And Eileen Prusher, you're just back from weeks there. What's your overall assessment? Is this reconstruction, this occupation, whatever you want to call it, is it gelling or is it fraying? Is it coming apart?
I got a sense that it wasn't really that well organized. I mean, the squadron I was with, which is just about 1,000 people, was led by a lieutenant colonel, and he was pretty much on his own while all the intrigue was going on in Baghdad. They had to go to the local bank and find out how much money was in a government account and take that money and distribute it themselves to try and get the economy going. They had to, you know, choose their own political candidates. And really, they were able to do a decent job of setting up a government because a lot of the senior officers had served time in Bosnia. But and many of the troops who had gone to Bosnia have gone through a special peacekeeping training. But people did not go through that training who deployed to Iraq.
Eileen Prusher in Istanbul, we've got a short delay in your line, but I want to put the same question to you. Was your overall impression that the rebuilding, the occupation, is gelling or coming apart?
Well, I would actually say that it's moving a lot more slowly than a lot of people in Iraq had hoped. What I would say is that the security situation seems to be falling apart a little bit. As had just been mentioned, things seem to be stabilizing for a while. And in the past month that I've been in Iraq, there's been an increasing number of attacks on coalition forces, particularly the U.S. forces, and now we're seeing attacks on British forces as well. But hand in hand with the security situation has been this political process that has sort of been long planned and anticipated both by Iraqis in and outside of Iraq. And there were expectations that somehow, once we saw the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime, that something would quickly take place, maybe not quickly, but at least in perhaps 2 months, we'd start to see some kind of interim authority. And what we've seen is sort of a shifting of gears a few times coming from the Bush administration. And now Paul Bremer, who's the top U.S. official in Iraq, will be appointing a political council sometime in the next month. But then we have to get to a constitutional convention, then send it to a referendum, and only then can we get to elections. At least that's the plan right now. I think a lot of Iraqis are upset about that, and that, given a sort of standstill in the economy and in the rebuilding process in general, has a lot of people feeling very frustrated and uncertain about their futures, and I think that's certainly fueling some of the violence.
Eileen, I want to get stories from all of you tonight. I wonder if you can give us some nitty-gritty that you witnessed on the interaction of American soldiers and Iraqis. How is that going? You know, we hear about the big sweeps through the so-called Sunni Triangle, women, children herded around, handcuffed, accidental deaths. Of course, that was in a very stern kind of military move there. But in general, what did you see? Share some stories with us about the quality of these interactions.
Well, it certainly varies. I mean, there are some soldiers who are involved in more day-to-day work. For example, I can think of the governor's office in Fallujah, for example, is protected by U.S. soldiers, and there's an acting mayor there, and actually that was a place that was attacked earlier this week. But you can certainly see examples of U.S. soldiers kind of interacting in a constructive way with Iraqis. At the same time, there's been this, somewhat aggressive disarming policy that perhaps makes sense from a military perspective, but a lot of Iraqis have taken it as a very worrisome sign. And what I'm talking about, for example, is the U.S. announced a weapons amnesty program and gave Iraqis 2 weeks to turn in most of their weapons or at least keep them at home. And I had stories, for example, I met one man who said, well, I've kept a gun in the glove compartment of my taxi for 10 years and never had to use it. I went through a checkpoint. The soldiers took it away from me, and 2 days later I was carjacked at gunpoint. Now I'm not only out of my weapon, I'm out of my car and my whole livelihood. You can hear stories like that almost on every corner in Baghdad right now. So it seems as though, on the one hand, we're seeing a policy that probably is well-intentioned, all of these house-to-house searches and that sort of thing. But at the same time, it's probably creating a lot of resentment among Iraqis who, A, don't like their weapons being taken away, and, B, find it very intrusive to have American soldiers coming into their homes and perhaps seeing their wives and children and that sort of thing. So it's a very sensitive subject, and I don't really know if there's an easy answer to it.
Eileen Prusher in Istanbul, Adam Puri, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation John Hendren. He's joining us from Washington tonight. He's Pentagon correspondent for the L.A. Times. He covered the occupation in post-war Baghdad, Fallujah, and Basra, left Iraq about 10 days ago, and will be going back soon. Good evening and welcome, John Hendren.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, John. John, we're looking for intimate, up-close, nitty-gritty stories tonight that help us kind of cut through the language out of the Pentagon and elsewhere about what's going on in the occupation, in the rebuilding of Iraq. A couple of questions for you. You haven't been back long. When you sit down, I don't know, with your closest friends and relatives and shake your head and say, here's what's going on, what do you tell them? Is this working or not? Do you think it's going to work or not? And what anecdotes do you share with them to take them to the heart of your experience, your witness in Iraq?
Well, the first thing I tell them is that it's a little like going to the Bronx. You know there are areas that are safe, and you know there are areas that are unsafe. But there's a lot of unpredictability there. And I wouldn't say so much that the security situation was falling apart as much as I would say that it appears that somewhat organized resistance has increased. Amid disaffection with the lack of power and basic safety and services in town. And things happen all the time there that would just be would be very shocking here. But we have a villa that we use as the LA Times bureau there. Our landlord's son-in-law was kidnapped at gunpoint on the street. This was in Baghdad,
yeah.
By a group that identified themselves as a Shiite militia, asked for $500,000 in ransom. I went to report this to the U.S. military, and when they found out it was not an American, they said, you need to report this to the Iraqi police. There really isn't a functioning Iraqi police force. There are thousands just beginning to get started. But it's kind of illustrative of the difficulty of even getting crimes reported. So when you hear statistics that suggest two people a day are reported killed in Baghdad, that really neglects the fact that a lot of people are killed and nobody ever hears about it.
So at that level, what do you think your Baghdad landlord thinks about this? His son was kidnapped. They wanted $500,000 in ransom. Is he grinding his teeth and saying these gosh darn Americans are just not doing this right? Or is he saying, like Donald Rumsfeld, this is kind of the hurly-burly aftermath of war?
Well, he came out of it all right. He was definitely not happy about the way the Americans had handled that. As it turned out, this group dropped off the kidnapped victim the next day and then asked retroactively to have $100,000 given to them or they would do it again.
A kind of a tip.
Exactly. And these kind of things happen all the time. There are just hostile areas. You go to Fallujah, and there is pretty pervasive disaffection with the U.S. presence there. If you go to a mosque and listen to what the sheikhs are saying, there's one sheikh I listened to said, we must resist the Americans. We must stomp on them with our bare feet as they have crushed us underneath their boots. There's pretty harsh language, especially when they knew that there were Westerners listening.
This is Fallujah, the Saddam heartland. Adam Puri, you've written about new parties, secret political parties being formed with names like Al-Auda, the return, as in Return of Saddam, and the April 28th party, that is Saddam's birthday. Do you have this? We'll come back and talk more about this, but do you have a sense that the Ba'athist party, the Ba'athist structure, is somehow behind the scenes knitting it all back together, putting a real increasingly united front up against the American occupation?
It's hard to say, but one thing I do know is that some of the attacks and some of the people they caught who were behind the attacks up where I was on the Syrian border in Al-Qaim actually came from Ramadi, Fallujah, the actual Sunni triangle. So I think there is a lot of travel within Iraq itself, and it's pretty easy to go places and be provocative.
So you're saying people are moving around the countries even so that the Sunni Saddam heartlanders can go almost anywhere and do something?
Yeah, and another thing is you have Saddam didn't just try and build weapons of mass destruction. He spent decades building up a huge armament of weapons. There's warehouses all over the country stocked with RPGs and different kinds of guns. And in the area I was, the military hadn't even gotten there yet.
Adam Piore, John Hendren, Eileen Prusher in Istanbul, please stand by. We're talking tonight about Iraq stories with firsthand correspondence reports of life and war after war. You can join us. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq stories with firsthand correspondence reports of life and war after war, up-close views of occupation and opportunities and danger in Iraq. My guests tonight are from Istanbul, Eileen Prusher. She's Istanbul Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, has been for weeks in Iraq. From Virginia, Adam Piore joins us tonight. He's general editor with Newsweek magazine. He was with the 3rd Armored Cavalry during the war, left Iraq about 10 days ago. And from Washington, John Hendren, Pentagon correspondent for the L.A. Times, just back from post-war Baghdad, Fallujah, Basra. You are welcome to put your question for any and all of these. What's your sense of what we are now in the midst of in Iraq? Are Americans, are you getting the full picture? And what's your question for the correspondents fresh from Baghdad from the occupation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Habu is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Habu. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening to all of you.
Good evening.
And thank you for having me on. You know, I find myself, just a couple of points, I find myself almost saying it's deja vu all over again. You know, after Gulf War I, people were crying here that we didn't get Saddam, and then they had Gulf War II to get the job done, but apparently it seems like it's not done fully, and I'm wondering if there's going to be a Gulf War III. Secondly, my second point is, why is it surprising that people in Iraq are not happy with the British and the Americans? That's no different for if other people had come to this country. But more importantly, when people knock down doors, frisk women, which is something that's very taboo in that society, mm-hmm. Do you think that this kind of reaction is surprising?
So, Habu, let me ask you very briefly. The Americans now have Iraq in their hands. They've promised to rebuild it, to make it an up-and-running democracy. What are they supposed to do?
Do you really believe all that rhetoric? You think we are really interested in the Iraqi welfare as much as what we are going there for other reasons?
Well, you can scrape the top off of that promise, but you know the Americans would like at least a stable Iraq that they don't have to stick around and spend billions of dollars on every year forever.
But do you think that there can be such a thing as a stable country in the middle of all this anarchy that's going on? You know, we're threatening Iran, perhaps Syria.
Habu, we've got it. Adam Piore, there's a real skeptic saying, hey, you guys, you're in the briar patch now and you're not getting out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult situation. At least now there's not any more executions from Saddam, but, you know, nobody's denying that it's a difficult situation.
John Hendren?
Well, you've got instability there. It's not clear whether that's going to last. There are people who are happy to be liberated from Saddam, mm-hmm. Whatever the U.S. motives might be. If you go outside of Baghdad, if you go down to Basra, obviously, there was an incident yesterday in which 6 Brits were killed. But in general, that's an area in which people are relieved to be rid of this regime. It's hard to say how pervasive this is. But if you could achieve security there, if you could get power running, it's just possible that people who were never necessarily terribly happy with the previous government might at least be willing to settle for whatever government is established there now, whatever they think of the U.S. motives.
And Eileen Prusher, let me put it to you. I mean, our caller is very skeptical of U.S. motives, but I think the core idea, and it may have been over-optimistic, was that out of self-interest, Iraqis would grab hold of an opportunity to have a new era there without the foot of a tyrant on their neck, would jump in, you know, build businesses, go to school, get back to life. And the U.S. could move off into the shadows, at least around the oil wells, perhaps. Have you seen signs of that happening?
Well, it sounds great. I can't say that I've seen signs of that happening yet. I guess what I've seen is the very basic groundwork of that. I mean, for example, you're starting to see some businesses reopening in Baghdad, even if it's just, you know, restaurants. But when you think about, you know, a complete sort of shutdown and chaos and looting in the economy, even those are signs. I know that Paul Bremer recently introduced there'd be some kind of Iraqi business forum that they're going to help run, and you know, a new stimulus package, all that sort of thing. But I think you know, back to the caller's point, you know, it's a point of view that I hear a lot in Iraq itself, and sometimes it's a bit worrying. There are a lot of people in Iraq who don't see the causes or the you know, the reasons for the war being anything remotely resembling the ones that the arguments that we heard you know, in the months leading up to the war. And you know, many Iraqis, even educated Iraqis whom I meet, often say that they think that, you know, there are reasons of oil behind it, or they think that the U.S. was acting to get rid of Saddam to help Israel. I don't necessarily subscribe to any of these viewpoints, but I think that they hold a lot of currency in Iraq, and it is a problem, because until the U.S. can prove that it's going to lead Iraq to a better place, and we know that it is on some level because it's rid of Saddam, but there's not an administration in its place, until Iraq is in a better place, I think these kind of skeptical and even views that even lead in the direction of conspiracy theories will continue to hold a lot of currency.
John Hendren, are there facts on the ground that can be pointed to in opposition to that kind of suspicion and skepticism? Can Paul Bremer, can the U.S. forces now say, look, here's what we've done, A, B, and C. Here are the power plants rebuilt. Here are the roads repaired. Here are the town councils set up. Do you begin to get that kind of report in briefings in Baghdad? Is there enough kind of hard factual evidence of progress that can be put before Iraqis, or are they just looking at what's before their eyes and not seeing enough to hang on to?
There are definitely things that they can point to. They can say that we have restored power in a number of areas. They can say that security is improved outside of this Sunni triangle people speak of. But it's not clear that enough has been done. It's not clear that the communications with the Iraqi people are very good either. There are a lot of myths that persist among sort of your man on the street. One of them is that the Americans use night vision goggles to see through the abayas of the Arab women. I've heard preached in mosques that Americans give out porno candy, which is, you know, you unwrap it and then there's a pornographic picture on the wrapper. They believe that the airport, that Americans used chemical weapons on the airport, and that's why Iraqis are not allowed inside. Actually, they're not allowed inside because it's an American military base now. Mm-hmm.
Eileen Prusher, I know we have to let you go in a moment. It's late there in Istanbul, but what's your general sense? Do you feel that this is headed toward something sustainable, or, you know, the fear that looks behind all this is that we'll get Iraqis all in a full lather about the American presence there, which is easily understood if things aren't going well, and it just becomes an impossible situation. What's your gut feeling about the direction?
My gut feeling is that things are at a crossroads, and I don't think that the U.S. is going to have a really long time. I think the sort of goodwill has a very short shelf life at the moment. I think this summer is going to be a sort of, you know, completely and let's say decisive moment for the entire post-war project. I don't think we have a long time for it to work well. So while I left Iraq less than a week ago feeling a little bit skeptical and worried, I don't think by any means that it's too far gone and that it can't be done at this point. But I think it might take some rethinking along the way to say, okay, we came up with this plan, and we thought the election should be further down the road, but if Iraqis want something sooner, then maybe we need to do that sooner, maybe appointing a political council. If it becomes unpopular and is seen as sort of a, you know, a somewhat of a puppet regime, which it could well be, then that maybe that needs to be reassessed. Mm. So I feel a little bit concerned about the way things are heading right now, but I don't think that we're to the point yet where we want to say, you know, that this is really more messed up than it was when we came in. Let's hope it doesn't get to that point.
Eileen Prusher, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Eileen Prusher is Istanbul bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor. She spent the last month in Baghdad, just left 6 days ago, and we appreciate her being with us tonight. From Rome, joining us right now, Yaroslav Trofimov. He's Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He was at Unilateral during the war and since has spent most of his time in southern Iraq. He's written on resistance there, especially on Shiite fundamentalists and left just a couple of weeks ago. Good evening and welcome, Yaroslav.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for joining us. Yaroslav, we're asking everybody tonight among the correspondents that we're talking to, since you've come out of Iraq, what are the stories that you're telling your friends, your relatives, your editors about what really is you found most revealing there about what's going on post-war with Iraq, with the Americans, with the occupation, with the rebuilding? What anecdotes really speak to the reality that you saw there?
Well, I think one really must make a distinction in Iraq now between these two societies, the Shiite majority of Iraq, which by and large still welcomes the fact that Saddam Hussein's regime has been overthrown, and which is not yet ready to take up arms against the U.S. and British forces, despite this incident we had a few days ago in Amara. And the Sunni minority, which was really privileged under the past regime and which lives in an area that now sees attacks every few hours against U.S. And British troops.
So if you're making that distinction, despite the attacks in Amara, are you feeling a level of confidence that the Shiite population is kind of on board, that the Saddam years were so bad that they're going to give the Americans a longer chance, more rope here?
Well, the Shiite population, the difference is that the Shiites, as a religious denomination, have a very clear religious hierarchy with Ayatollahs and other clerics. And so these clerics, who control their people much more than the Sunni clerics, have made a political choice so far to stay away from violence. And that's what they're telling, what they're preaching. If you go and listen to them in the mosques, they would also vent their frustration against the Americans and say occupation is horrible, and we want our freedom, and the Americans are mismanaging our country and stealing our oil. But they would also say, do not kill them. Do not go and attack them. Let's do it peacefully. And that's not the kind of language we're hearing in the Sunni areas, where the attacks, most of the attacks have been happening.
And the language in the Sunni areas is very explicit and very angry.
Well, exactly, yes. And if you look at the walls, just on the streets in places like Tikrit or Fallujah, the graffiti speaks for itself. It says Saddam is coming back and will kill everybody who is dealing with the infidels. So the threats are not just against Americans, but also against all those Iraqis who are brave enough to cooperate with the American forces.
And here I see a photograph from Newsweek. Big English letters and Arabic, not far from the American headquarters in Fallujah. Sooner or later, U.S. killers will kick you out. That can't be very comforting. Newsweek reports that the soldiers there call their outpost the Alamo. We're going to hear more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Adam Buri, how about it? That comes from the reporting of you and your colleagues. And we read today that there are even reports that the Shiite hierarchy was infiltrated during Saddam Hussein's years with high officials who may now be working to turn that group sour on American occupation as well. How effective do you think the Ba'athists, the remnants of the Saddam loyalists, can be? How effective are they in fomenting unrest, violence, not just in the Sunni Triangle, but around the country?
Well, yeah, that's part of the problem. Regarding Fallujah, they actually moved their compound out of town because they were getting attacked too much. The unit that was there now there's just a small group of soldiers right next to where the mayor's office is. So they're out by a lake,
out of harm's way, or at least further from it.
Right, but up in Al-Qaim where I was, they didn't know who was the enemy. They had a meeting when we first got there with the chief of police, and he was very eager to help and wanted to go on joint patrols. And a week later, they had arrested him because it turned out he had been an assassin for the Saddam Hussein regime. And, even 2 weeks ago when I left, some of the sheikhs that had been giving them the most advice, it turned out, had links to the Iraqi intelligence service, and they were, banging down their doors and finding all sorts of weapons and stuff. So, they're still trying to figure out who's on what side, and that's delaying the process as well.
Not an easy picture. Maurice is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Maurice. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
I guess I hear a lot of ifs, like if we restore security, if we give the people back what they need to survive day by day, and not a lot of whens, I guess. If I were on the ground in a country that had been occupied by a force that came to liberate me, I'd be more interested in when than if. I guess it's a common expectation of when you're promised something.
So you're saying Iraqis might be understandably wigging out when these things aren't happening.
Right, regardless of what group they're in, what Muslim classification we give them, I think people are people, and they're going to be expecting, you know, at least somewhat quicker results than 10 years from now if we have troops that stay there for 10 years to free them and to give them democracy as we promised.
Yeah, that's understandable. Maurice, thanks for your call. John Hendren, how about it? We now read about the administration talking about putting major infrastructure projects off until 2005 because the expenses are running ahead of where they thought they might be. The oil revenues are not flowing where they thought they might be. As you watched from Iraq, what was your response? Did you think, well, there must be limits to the American obligation here, even though the U.S. invaded, the Iraqis should stand up and get this done somehow themselves, or that the Americans promised something that they weren't delivering, and Iraqis may be pushed into open opposition because of it?
The Iraqis definitely expect the Americans to solve all of the major problems there. And there is a definite perception that because they came there and deposed the previous government, which for all of its faults made the trains run on time and kept the streets relatively safe as long as you didn't need to be kept safe from the regime, they expect the Americans to solve those problems. And the outlook is not good in the short term. It looks like it's going to take a long time. Joseph Biden and Richard Lugar, two senators who just came back from Iraq, they say it's going to take at least 5 years. And if you look at the streets of Baghdad, which are rubble-strewn and trash-strewn, although I guess the garbage is beginning to be picked up there, it just looks like an enormous job that's going to take a long time.
And the Iraqi patience, will Iraqis hunker down and wait, or can you imagine them coalescing in a kind of national opposition to the American presence?
I think that there is a relationship between how quickly the Americans are responding, or how quickly that coalition provisional authority is responding to the major problems of safety, power, goods in markets, that sort of thing, and the resistance that you're seeing. One of the problems is you've got 500,000 people, men, who were in the Iraqi army or in the Republican Guard, who are now out of work. Those people are angry. A lot of them live in places like Fallujah, where the regime drew people from in order to fill the army. And they're jobless. The Bremer says that they're not going to hire Baathists back in the army. Although they're reconstituting the army, it looks like they're setting up a much smaller army. So you've got 1% of the population of a 25-million-person country out of work with no hope of getting a new job. Those people are going to be angry, and having their services restored is not going to be the same as having some kind of economic opportunities for them.
And those are the men we saw at the end of American bayonet points just a couple of days ago. Not a pretty image, but reality. We're talking tonight about Iraq stories with correspondents fresh back from Iraq. Adam Piori of Newsweek, John Hendren of the LA Times, Yaroslav Trofimov of the Wall Street Journal. You can join the conversation. What's your sense of where we are now in Iraq? Are Americans getting the full picture? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq stories with firsthand correspondence reports of life and war after war, their up-close views of occupation, opportunities, danger in Iraq. You can join the conversation from afar. Does the Iraqi resistance look organized to you? Does the U.S. occupation look organized? How can the U.S. enforce order without alienating Iraqi civilians? And are you confident that Washington's view of Iraq's future will one day be Iraq's future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, joining us from Rome, Yaroslav Trofimov, Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. From Virginia, Adam Piori, general editor from Newsweek, and from Washington, D.C., John Hendren, Pentagon correspondent for the L.A. Times, all very recently back from Iraq. You can join them at 1-800-423-8255. Roger's calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for taking my call, and thank
you
for the interesting program.
Sure.
I have a question for whichever the panelist wants to take it, or all of them, and I would like the chance to follow up briefly.
But great. Let's hear it.
The question is this. it seems that the Shiite population, which one of your guests mentioned, was, you know, pretty well controlled by the clerics, have made a political decision for the time being to withhold, to not pursue a course of violent resistance. But it seems to me that that's a calculation they're making, that that the promise of democracy that's been offered will be fulfilled, and that with a 60% majority of the population, through a democratic process, they'll be able to take control.
That it would fall in their laps, and I hear you kind of presuming along with that that clerical rule would follow. We'll give you a follow-up, but Yaroslav Trofimov, let's put that to you first. Do you see, do you sense a kind of strategic positioning here by the Shiites waiting for the Americans to build whatever they're going to build, get some democracy up on the rails, and then it falls to them?
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is the calculation by the Shiite clergy. Of course, not all the Shiites in Iraq want the clerics to rule, and not all among the 60% are Islamic fundamentalists. But the Shiites have been oppressed not just by Saddam Hussein, but throughout the history of Iraq under the monarchy or under the Ottoman rule in the 19th century and earlier. The Shiites were not allowed to be in positions of power. So for them, it's a once-in-a-millennium opportunity.
So as you talk to them, does this look like something that is of concern to American planners and occupation officials there? Or are they saying, look, if we get the trains running here, the Shiites will be more interested in democracy and the good life than in clerical rule? We're not worried about it.
Oh, yeah, it's obviously a concern because nobody in the U.S. administration wants a Shiite religious state alongside the lines of Iran to emerge in Iraq. Mm-hmm. That would be the disaster scenario for the war. And therefore, there is a lot of concern about this and a lot of effort to keep this clerical influence at bay and to compete with these clerics in the Shiite areas by providing more services.
Roger, you said you had a follow-up. Sorry, Yaroslav. Roger, are you there?
Thank you. Well, yeah, the follow-up is this. It seems the United States government has made a pretty unequivocal pronouncement that they would not accept a government led by the clerics that was sympathetic to Iran, for example. And it seems that the clerics themselves and the fundamentalist regimes we've seen around the world aren't very good at taking no for an answer. And so it seems there's a rock and a hard place that's going to end at some point in some level of conflict.
So are we headed into a box here? Roger, thanks for your call. Yaroslav, what do you think?
Well, not necessarily, because not all the Shiite clerics in Iraq want an Iranian-style regime. And the most senior one of them, Ayatollah Sistani Najaf, mm-hmm. has been a critic of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran for many, many years and has been a critic of this approach. And he says that the clerics should stay away from politics. So there is still a large body of this Shiite clerical establishment in Iraq that the U.S. can work with. Mm. And obviously the Shiites know that they are 60%, but they are not the entire population. So they have to work out some sort of a deal with the Kurds in the north, who are not at all inclined towards a religious state, and with the Sunnis eventually. Mm. So I think this battle is not lost yet.
John Hendren, let me put another kind of big theory to you, maybe conspiracy theory, that I know Americans have, many of them have heard at this point, just sitting miles away and wondering what's going on. You know, the notion that's sort of out and about that Saddam Hussein deliberately pulled his troops back from the big direct confrontation with American troops, deliberately let them bleed back into the population, and that now, you know, he's off in some bunker or hut orchestrating very cleverly a kind of pick them off one by one, unsettle the waters, make the country uninhabitable by Americans strategy that lays the groundwork for even a return of his Ba'athist party. Does it sound like nonsense to you or possible?
Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense in that you can't see the possibility for Saddam Hussein himself coming back. So there's not a lot of incentive for him mm-hmm. to do that. If he comes back, he is already a target of U.S. forces. They've said they're going to capture or kill him. There's not really any good reason for him to do that. However, it is clear that a lot of people a lot of supporters of his regime who oppose the U.S. occupation have laid low and are now among those who are taking shots at U.S. troops. There is definitely some coordination going on here.
We saw General Richard Myers. Well, the Pentagon last week was saying they saw no coordination, and just in the last day or two, General Myers is saying, well, we're not sure. These could be, leaving open the possibility that these are coordinated attacks. Adam Piori, what's your view?
Well, I do think that there was a certain point where the number of attacks sort of exploded a few weeks ago, and up where I was, a lot of for many weeks, people had been following the troops on motorcycles, and I'd heard that from a lot of other commanders in other areas, which is that's a vehicle that many of Saddam's fedayeen use.
This is Iraqis trailing along behind American troops. To what purpose?
To figure out their patterns, to become familiar with them, so they could then lay ambushes and then cause problems. And at a certain point, just, you know, in northwest Iraq, the number of attacks just exploded. Not many of them were effective, but it seemed like a lot of people who had been laying low suddenly started to attack. But, you know, I don't know how they would maintain contact or coordinate it. But
can you imagine then the U.S. somehow facing a coordinated national resistance movement?
Not at this point. I mean, most of the Army's heavy armor has been destroyed. You know, a lot of their artillery. It's just small arms against fleets of helicopters and gunships and tanks and armored vehicles.
But not tiny arms. I mean, we saw RPGs, heavy machine guns, Chinook helicopters under fire. I mean, enough to create at least a political problem for both Britain and the United States, don't you think?
Yeah, I think they'd have to do a lot more damage to actually, you know, escalate the situation. But, yeah, it's definitely an effective way of causing political problems and increasing pressure back home to get them to leave. No question about that.
John Hendren, and our time is running down here, but a sense of how the American troops are doing there. Newsweek quotes one colonel saying, "You don't know where or who your enemy is. You don't know who to trust and what to act on." What did you see among the troops? How are they holding up?
Well, some of those troops have been there for a very, very long time. They went there to fight a war. This is not the mission they wanted to fight. They're not particularly happy about doing it. On the other hand, they're soldiers and they do what they're told. But they also see what we all read about and watch on television every day, and that is that in Fallujah alone there used to be 1,200 U.S. troops. Now there are 3,800, nearly 4,000 troops, and the number of attacks is actually going up. They know that they're not solving the problem. I think they feel that they're making some overall progress and that this is sort of a small subgroup that's causing these problems. But I don't think morale is particularly good right now.
And we're talking about years. I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us tonight. John Hendren in Washington with the LA Times, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Adam Piori, general editor at Newsweek magazine, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And in Rome, Yaroslav Trofimov, Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, just back from Iraq. Thank you very much for staying up to be with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. A top State Department official reportedly told a congressional committee meeting behind closed doors last week that he was pressured to tailor his analysis on Iraq to fit the Bush administration's agenda. The House Intelligence Committee has been meeting to investigate how the administration used intelligence to justify war with Iraq. Meanwhile, the clamor for open-door hearings is getting louder. Yesterday, West Virginia Democrat Robert Byrd attacked the Bush administration on the Senate floor for overstating the threat Iraq posed to the United States. He said the American people deserve open hearings on pre-war intelligence, saying that the road to cover-up is the road to ruin. Here are excerpts from Robert Byrd's speech.
We have heard a lot about revisionist history from the White House of late, in answer to those who question whether there was ever a real threat from Iraq. But it is the president who appears to me to be intent on revising history. On January 28, 2003, President Bush said in his State of the Union address, "The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Yet, according to news reports, the CIA knew that this claim was false as early as March 2002. On February 5, Secretary of State Colin Powell told the United Nations Security Council, "Our conservative estimate is that Iraq today has a stockpile of between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons agent. That is enough to fill 16,000 battlefield rockets." But, Mr. President, the truth is, to date, we have not found any of this material, nor those thousands of rockets loaded with chemical weapons. On March 30, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, during the height of the war, said of the search for weapons of mass destruction, "We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north somewhat." Well, Mr. President, Baghdad fell to our troops on April 9 and Tikrit on April 14, and the intelligence that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld spoke about has not led us to any weapons of mass destruction. On September 26, 2002, just 2 weeks before Congress voted on a resolution to allow the president to invade Iraq, and 6 weeks before the midterm elections, President Bush himself built the case that Iraq was plotting to attack the United States. After meeting with members of Congress on that date, the president said, "The danger to our country is grave. The danger to our country is growing. The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons. The regime is seeking a nuclear bomb and with fissile material could build one within a year." Well, these are the president's words. He said that Saddam Hussein is seeking a nuclear bomb. Have we found any evidence to date of this chilling allegation? No. This is the kind of pumped-up intelligence and outrageous rhetoric that were given to the American people to justify war with Iraq. This is the same kind of hyped evidence that was given to Congress to sway its vote for war. It is in the compelling national interest, Mr. President, to examine what we were told about the threat from Iraq. This is not revisionist history. These words are plain English words. The American people have questions that need to be answered about why we went to war with Iraq. To attempt to deny the relevance of these questions is to trivialize the people's trust and confidence.
West Virginia Democratic Senator Robert Byrd speaking on the Senate floor yesterday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.